Due to the graphic nature of this kingpin's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of sex and drug abuse that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13.
It was the fall of 1973. Howard Marks was waiting in a long line for a customs check in Brussels, Belgium, after a flight from Dublin. Howard did a lot of international flying, and customs was usually a breeze. But this time, he was uncharacteristically anxious. The closer he got to the front of the line, the harder his heart pounded.
Howard was a cannabis smuggler, and right now, he was hot. A massive shipment of marijuana he was overseeing had just been seized by the DEA. Howard couldn't be sure if his identity had been given to the authorities, but he'd taken the proper precautions.
He presented the immigration officer with a false passport. Howard's name for today was Peter Hughes. And now it was the moment of truth. Howard tried to keep his face neutral.
The officer glanced at the passport and said, "Howard?" Howard's blood ran cold. This was it. How had this Belgian recognized him?
But then, the officer chuckled and stamped the passport. He hadn't suspected a thing. It was a joke linking Howard's alias, Peter Hughes, to Howard Hughes, the obsessive billionaire. Howard quickly regained his footing and laughed along. There was just something about Howard. His good humor was contagious, and it was always saving his skin. But that luck wouldn't last forever.
I'm Howell Hargett.
And I'm Kate Leonard, and this is Kingpins, a Parcast original. Every Friday, we journey inside the ranks of organized crime rings, from street gangs to mafiosos, to understand how a kingpin or queenpin rises to the top of the underworld.
And why they fall. As we follow the lives of infamous crime bosses, we'll explore how money and power change them, and how it changed the community around them. You can find episodes of Kingpins and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Kingpins for free on Spotify, just open the app, tap Browse, and type Kingpins in the search bar.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help us.
This is our first episode on Howard Marks, a legendary Welsh cannabis smuggler. Over his 18-year career, Howard used international contacts and over 40 aliases to transport tons of cannabis by air, sea, and land. He was finally imprisoned in 1990.
Out of Howard Marks' many aliases, he selected Mr. Nice as the title of his autobiography. The chosen moniker is appropriate. Howard's college friend John Nicholson said, "There was instant sunshine wherever Howard went."
In a profession synonymous with secrecy and deceit, Howard somehow endured through a decades-long career without making any enemies among his peers. He was known for his loyalty and took pride in his adherence to a gentleman's business code, sealing deals with, quote, "the shake of the hand, the look in the eye."
Howard's nonviolent approach to business made him unique among other drug dealers. In fact, he once said that his greatest skill and the key to his success was diplomacy.
Howard's diplomatic prowess was pushed to its absolute limit during his very first big deal in mid-1971, when he was 26. At that time, Howard was working with an unhinged Irishman named James McCann.
McCann was a member of the Irish Republican Army, the IRA, which was inches away from war with Britain. When McCann wasn't smuggling drugs, he was smuggling guns and explosives for the IRA. And when he wasn't smuggling, he was drinking, watching illegal porn, or name-dropping famous friends. According to McCann, John Lennon was always about to stop by.
On that day in 1971, it was Howard's job to make sure McCann held up his end of the deal, shepherding 200 pounds of Afghani hashish through Shannon Airport, into a car, and out to a stash house in the Irish countryside. Hashish was still on the rise in the United Kingdom, but Howard was already experienced with selling it within the nation. This would be his first chance to oversee the shipment all the way from its origin in Afghanistan.
Howard was uncharacteristically nervous. They'd never tried this route before, and they'd never moved a stash this big.
He also didn't know McCann well enough to trust him. This wild drunk of an Irishman could tank the mission at any second, but if they pulled it off, they'd all be very, very rich men.
Howard was dozing off in his hotel room, waiting for news about the hashish. It was a bit like waiting for a baby to be born. He didn't know exactly when it would arrive at Shannon Airport, but he knew it would be soon.
Howard jerked awake to answer his phone. McCann's belligerent voice was shouting on the other end. Howard rushed down to the hotel lobby, thinking there was a problem. But McCann was all smiles.
McCann led Howard down to the parking garage beneath the hotel and pointed out an ancient, rusty Ford. McCann hadn't delivered the hashish to the safe house as planned. He'd brought it here.
The hashish was inside two giant crates. One sat in the back seat, unsecured, and the other was in the trunk. The trunk was wide open because the crate was too large to allow the hatch to close. No effort had been made to hide or disguise the cargo. The car wasn't even locked. The entire thing reeked of hashish.
Where Howard saw a disaster, however, McCann saw success. He congratulated himself on a job well done and demanded the keys to Howard's rental car. Before Howard knew what was happening, McCann was speeding off in Howard's rental, leaving him to deal with the smelly Ford. But Howard was Mr. Nice. He let it roll off his back. It seemed that he would be the one driving to the stash house.
Howard struggled to get the Ford to start. When the car finally came to life, he immediately noticed that the gas gauge was on empty. The body of the car was practically dragging on the ground under the extra 200 pounds it was carrying.
Howard managed to pilot the limping vehicle to a nearby gas station. Among the other worn-out cars at the station, the creaky Ford fit right in.
Once the gas tank was full, Howard drove all the way to the cottage they'd rented to store the drugs. To give you a sense of just how remote this cottage was, the address was Paradise Cottage, Paradise House, Paradise. Their landlord had advised putting that it's near Ballycally on any incoming mail. Not surprisingly, Howard didn't hit any traffic on the way.
Soon enough, McCann arrived in Howard's rental car. Howard was relieved to see the rental was still in one piece. They went into the stash house and chain-smoked joints to celebrate. According to Howard, McCann tore around the room screaming, "I've done it! The kid's done it!" The partnership had been a success. Despite McCann's wild card attributes, he'd pulled through. If things kept up, this was the beginning of quite the lucrative partnership.
After McCann fell asleep, Howard reclaimed the keys to his rental and drove it out to a phone box to let his partner know that the stash had arrived. His partner was pleasantly surprised to learn of the deal's success. Howard was too. It had been a little close for comfort.
As Howard walked back to his rental car, he noticed something unfamiliar in the trunk. It was full of cardboard boxes of chemicals, insulated by stacks of phone books. McCann must have left them in there when he took the car. Confused but unperturbed, Howard drove back to the stash house to ask what the chemicals were for.
In his intimidating, incomprehensible Belfast accent, McCann informed Howard that the car was full of explosives. After all the events of the day, Howard would have had good reason to fly off the handle. But instead, the unflappable Howard Marks simply advised McCann, "Well, take them out of there, Jim. Stick them in your wreck."
After that tense day, Howard did many, many more deals with McCann, until McCann was finally busted smuggling drugs and a shipment of bananas in the late 70s. That scheme would have gone off without a hitch if McCann hadn't aggressively screamed at a passing couple while transporting the load.
For Howard, no risk, even a deranged Irishman, was ever too big. Perhaps he was able to approach risk so casually because he had spent virtually his entire life getting away with things. Howard's schemes usually succeeded. And even when he did fail, his bad behavior almost never resulted in consequences. In fact, it was usually the opposite.
Howard Marks was born on August 13, 1945, in Kenfig Hill, near Bridgend, Wales. In 1957, when Howard was about 12 years old, he decided to become ill because, quote, he was bored with school. So he flicked up the mercury in the thermometer to make it appear like he had a 104-degree fever, and he was admitted to the hospital.
Howard relished the fallout of his mysterious illness. The nurses at the hospital were all beautiful. He thoroughly enjoyed all the mind-altering substances doctors dosed him with. His first racket was a success, and it taught him a lesson he would live by for the rest of his life. The rules didn't apply to him.
Despite Howard's casual truancy, he was singled out in grammar school for his intelligence. He was the first student from his school in 8 years to apply to Oxford, one of the top universities in the United Kingdom. Despite an impressive drinking habit and only middling effort, Howard was accepted into the university in 1964. At age 18, Howard had learned that for him, success was attainable without much effort.
He was the pride and joy of his parents and his entire Welsh neighborhood. From his perspective, the achievement didn't feel that significant. He had just taken a few exams and chatted with old Oxford muckety-mucks. Everyone else made such a fuss. But Howard never had to try too hard. People just liked him.
Howard's social draw and sizable stash of drugs and alcohol made his dorm room one of the major party spots at Oxford. It was where everyone got together to socialize, listen to rock and roll, and drink. But in 1965, during Howard's second year in college, the happening would take on a new focus: cannabis. Specifically, Kif, a Moroccan cannabis powder that made up the innards of Howard's first joint. It was the beginning of a long, happy love affair.
Music and partying took priority over studying. When his academic obligations caught up with him, Howard was known to take shortcuts.
In 1965, all the students at Oxford were pulling a frantic overnighter studying for a big exam, except Howard. Instead of studying, Howard approached the night porter, the equivalent of a dorm resident advisor.
In a smooth lie, Howard claimed he was locked out of his room. When the night porter asked for Howard's room number, he gave the room number of the professor giving the exam. Howard let himself into the professor's room and found the list of questions. The next day, he passed the exam easily.
Howard graduated from Oxford in 1968 with a degree in, of all things, nuclear physics. This was the subject that he had determined was the easiest for him to take without having to kick his drinking habit. British culture at the time was more drug-saturated than it had ever been before. After the Beatles released their psychedelic album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, their manager, Brian Epstein, succumbed to an overdose of sedatives. The leader of the Rolling Stones, Brian Jones, was imprisoned on a drug charge. And all the stoned hippies, including Howard, were protesting the war in Vietnam.
But Howard didn't see a career in the drug trade for himself just yet. Anticipating a delightfully stoned academic career, Howard applied for a postgraduate program in philosophy of science at Sussex University and was accepted in 1969 when he was 24.
During this time, Howard tutored undergraduate students and sold hashish to his friends to pay for his own smoking habit. His primary drug source was fellow Oxford graduate Graham Plinston, who Howard wrote lived in a flat one would expect to find belonging to a successful rock singer. It was cool, and it said Graham had money.
Although Howard's partying continued relatively uninterrupted, Howard found the actual postgraduate work frustrating. He thought Sussex University was dingy and narrow-minded compared to Oxford. At the beginning of 1970, Howard spent his tuition money on a new stereo and dealt even more of Graham's hashish to keep his finances afloat.
Howard's life seemed to be headed for academic doldrums until later that year when Graham's wife called Howard in tears. Graham was in trouble, and he needed Howard's help. But if Howard went to assist, he knew it wouldn't be a one-time thing. Saying yes to the job was saying yes to the life of a drug runner.
Coming up, Howard's rescue mission turns into a smuggling career.
Now, back to the story.
Throughout the late 1960s, Howard Marks lived the life of a disillusioned academic with a predilection for pot smoking and rock and roll. But everything changed with one phone call in 1970 when Howard was 25.
When Howard picked up the phone, a tearful woman was on the other end. It was Mandy, the wife of Howard's cannabis dealer, Graham Plinston. She was hysterical as she told Howard that Graham had disappeared in Germany. Mandy begged Howard to go to Germany, meet up with Graham's business partner, Klaus, and find out what happened.
According to Mandy, Howard was the only one of Graham's friends with a clean record, and therefore the only one who could travel easily. She offered to cover all his expenses. Howard had never been on a plane before, and this sounded like a fun adventure. He agreed and got on a flight to Frankfurt, Germany.
Klaus told Howard that Graham had been busted while driving from Geneva, Switzerland to Frankfurt. He'd been driving a Mercedes with 100 pounds of hashish stuffed beneath the door panels and under the back seat. Graham was jailed in Lerach, a tiny town near the German-Swiss border.
Howard hopped on a small plane out to the border. He'd enjoyed his first flight on a jet, but this little propeller plane was downright scary. Howard gripped the armrest for the entire flight.
Upon landing in Lerach, he set about finding a lawyer to take on Graham's case. Howard didn't speak any German, but he wasn't intimidated. He simply wandered around town until he found a lawyer. Once the lawyer had visited Graham, Howard called Mandy to update her.
He told her that the lawyer said Graham had no messages for her, but he looked all right. Mandy was relieved to hear that her husband was holding up, but there were still more problems to solve. She asked Howard if he would check in with Graham's supplier. Howard was happy to. He was curious to learn more about Graham's business.
Graham's supplier was named Mohammad Durrani, a descendant of the Durrani dynasty that controlled Afghanistan during the 18th and 19th centuries. Durrani was an eclectic businessman with connections all across Europe.
Howard writes that Mr. Durrani had a hawk-like face, Savile Row suit, beautifully manicured fingernails, and wore strong aftershave. He poured me a Johnny Walker Black Label whiskey. Very high class.
Mr. Durrani probed Howard on whether Graham would talk to the police. Howard shrewdly defended his friend and offered all the information he had about the bust and about Graham's lawyer.
Howard's forthright manner must have set Mr. Durrani at ease, because the next question he asked was whether Howard would be willing to sell the merchandise that was still headed to England without Graham.
Howard was blown away. He'd only sold a few ounces of cannabis to his friends before, and had no idea what he would do with the several hundred pounds in the pipeline to England. He didn't understand how he had won the trust of this international drug dealer so quickly, but he accepted.
Howard had agreed to fly to Germany to help Graham out of a tight spot. He'd thought it would be a one-off adventure. But faced with the possibility of distributing marijuana on a massive scale was even more exciting. Suddenly, he felt like his life had direction.
Howard's trip to Germany was a turning point in his life. The logistics of cannabis importation would become his full-time job for the next 18 years, and his relationships with Graham and Durrani would last throughout his entire career.
Howard dove into the lifestyle head first. Once Graham was released from jail in mid-1970, Howard worked with him to sell hashish by the kilogram in Britain and occasionally carried large amounts of cash through airports.
In late 1970, Howard got his first chance to do the very thing that got Graham busted: drive a car stuffed to the gills with cannabis around a foreign country and deliver it to buyers from Germany, California, and the Netherlands.
If all went well, Howard would earn 10,000 British pounds. In today's currency, that would equal over $180,000.
Howard was excited at the prospect of more responsibility and more money. But he was nervous about driving on the right side of the road in foreign countries. Driving a vehicle stuffed with illegal hashish didn't seem like the ideal way to learn. He opted to partner with a friend named Long, an experienced smuggler who agreed to do all the driving. They would split the 10,000 pound fee.
Howard and Long flew into Frankfurt and rented a palatial estate car with an impressively large trunk for baggage. They drove to the appointed stash garage in an expensive suburb.
Inside the garage were 20 wooden crates, each containing 50 kilos of hashish. They'd come all the way from Karachi. Breathing in the heady scent, Howard and Long loaded crates into the car.
Then Howard was off to his first meet with what he describes as Cheech and Chong lookalikes, i.e. Californians. Howard found the transaction surprisingly simple. He and Long helped transfer the crates and returned to their hotel.
They had a few days before their German and Dutch buyers would be ready to receive their share of the cannabis. Howard and Long enjoyed themselves, eating, drinking, and smoking.
The day before they planned to meet with their Dutch hookup, they were crossing a busy street to pick up some English newspapers. Long was almost hit by a car. He smacked the offending vehicle with a newspaper as it went by.
The motorist got out, punched Long in the face, and left him bleeding on the pavement. In addition to his head injury, Long's glasses were pulverized. He was blind without them. Howard would have to drive to the meeting with the Dutch buyers tomorrow. He was terrified.
The next day, Howard drove the car as best he could, but it was slow going. The Dutch had arranged a drop-off in an isolated clearing deep in the Black Forest.
They waited in the empty clearing for 20 minutes. There was only one way in or out, and Howard hated feeling trapped. Finally, the Dutch pulled up in two Volvos. The men inside introduced themselves as Dutch Nick and Dutch Peter. Much like with the Californians, the actual transfer of goods was quick and simple. They moved the product, and all parties departed.
The last drop was even easier. A quick exchange with their German contact in a car park, and their work was done. Long headed back to England to recuperate. Howard opted to spend a few more days in Frankfurt, helping Graham collect bags of American dollars and German marks from all their buyers.
Then, Graham purchased a brand new BMW, hid the cash inside it, and drove with Howard to Geneva, Switzerland. There, he paid Howard his £5,000 and safeguarded the rest of his profits in Swiss bank accounts. Howard was taking notes on every step of the process. A few years down the road, he would be doing the exact same thing.
Graham told Howard where the hashish he'd distributed was headed. The Californians would purchase European cars, fill them with the drugs, and ship them back to Los Angeles. Their German contact would sell his share right there in Frankfurt. And Dutch Nick and Dutch Peter were driving their own vehicle back to England.
Howard had no idea that Dutch Nick and Dutch Peter were the ones who were delivering the hashish Howard had been selling in Britain. He was finally piecing together all the different parts of Graham and Durrani's pipeline.
Howard did several driving expeditions with Graham during 1970 and 1971, carrying hashish and money across international borders. He later said, "When you cross that border, it's like a religious flash or a non-sexual orgasm. It's a wonderful feeling when you get through, and I've never had it with anything else."
Howard also learned more about how Durrani's end of the business worked. All the incriminatingly fragrant hashish he delivered went through a crucial smell-proofing process at the point of origin.
His methods were very strict and complicated, but generally they worked. In Durrani's warehouse in Kabul, he'd assemble massive groups of workers into an assembly line. Hashish would be packed into 500-gram blocks, then sealed inside plastic bags. The bags would be washed with gasoline, then left sitting out for hours.
Fresh workers who had never touched the hashish would then move the bags into metal bins in a separate room and weld the bin shut.
Then the sealed metal bins would also be washed with gas and moved to yet another room. Waiting there were even larger metal bins with a few inches of warm animal fat at the bottom.
The smaller metal bins were placed inside the larger ones, the fat filling any extra space. Then the larger metal bins were welded shut, placed in a cardboard box, and taped closed.
Finally, Durrani used his contacts in local law enforcement to arrange for a drug-sniffing dog to drop by the warehouse. If the dog didn't react to the boxes, they were ready to ship.
But the smell-proofing was only the start of Durrani's process. He also had relationships with Pakistani diplomats working all across Europe. Hashish would be sealed in with a diplomat's personal furniture and belongings and shipped wherever the diplomat was appointed.
Searching a diplomat's belongings at customs would be a political and bureaucratic quagmire, so the parcels usually sailed through. But if a stash ever was uncovered, the carriers could claim diplomatic immunity.
Once the diplomats were settled in, Howard and a partner would enter their residence, crack open the crates of furniture and personal effects, and remove several hundred pounds of hashish. Then they would distribute the hashish among their European contacts. Howard's fee for his role in this scheme was £7,500.
As Howard took part in more smuggling jobs with Graham, the cash started to pile up. By 1971, he needed help laundering his money, so he turned to Graham's creative accountant, Patrick Lane. Howard invested in a ball gown designing business, with which Patrick helped logistically.
But Howard also kept doing what he loved best in life, getting people very stoned and giving them good food and wine. He loved entertaining, especially his business partners and women. Every time he went out to the bar, he always picked up the tab.
Howard was spending thousands of pounds a month by mid-1971, but it didn't worry him. He knew he was only getting a very thin cut of the vast sums the operation made, and if he was willing to take on bigger risks, he could make a lot more. He and Graham decided to give Durrani another secure location to send an enormous shipment of hashish. But as their operation grew, they knew they would need to take on additional help. including some dangerous characters.
Up next, Howard and Graham are introduced to a certain deranged Irishman. Now, back to the story.
By mid-1971, Howard Marks was 26 and had built a solid career as a mid-level drug smuggler. But he was ready to move up to the big leagues, taking sole responsibility for over 90 kilos of hashish, worth more than 20,000 British pounds. Adjusted for inflation, that's over 200,000 pounds or $240,000 today.
But if Howard wanted a bigger share of the profits, he needed to find a new partner with access to a port, so he wouldn't have to cut in Durrani's diplomats.
Howard and Graham heard about James McCann from an unexpected source, an underground magazine called Friends. Their mutual friend, Charlie Radcliffe, interviewed McCann for the magazine, painting him as an Irish folk hero fighting for Irish freedom from the British. Irish children invoked his name to mock British soldiers on their streets.
The reality of McCann was something very different. In 1971, Howard and Graham arrived in the small Irish village of Ballinskelligs to meet one of McCann's business partners, Alan Markison.
Alan immediately warned them not to get into business with McCann. He was a dangerous lunatic, drunk and high all day long, recklessly stashing explosives and storing his illegal guns in the abandoned insane asylum nearby.
But McCann had what Howard and Graham needed. He had access to the Shannon Airport on the Irish Atlantic coast. It was the European airport closest to North America, so nearly all transatlantic flights refuel there.
The area around Shannon Airport had been declared a free port, so raw goods shipped there could be taken directly from airplanes to manufacturing sites without going through customs. Hundreds of factory workers moved in and out of the area all day.
McCann set up his own little business front, and he could receive the goods without a customs check. When McCann brought Howard to the airport, he summed up his tour with, "This place is wide open." Howard had to agree. This looked very promising.
While Howard and Graham waited for the airport to get up and running, they participated in another deal out of Holland through Durrani's diplomats. Howard made 1,500 pounds from selling his portion of hashish, and the diplomats made 20,000. It pained Howard to know how much money he was missing out on, but it made him even more determined to make sure his new plan worked out.
Howard's expectations for Shannon Airport weren't quite calibrated. The first 90 kilos of hashish that McCann drove out of the airport in that ancient Ford were sold for 20,000 pounds. There were a lot of people that needed to be paid, and no one got rich on that first deal.
But the important thing was, the setup was proven effective. Now they could increase their volume and their profits.
By the end of 1972, roughly a year after their first successful shipment, Shannon Airport was proving quite lucrative. It wasn't consistent, but when it worked, it worked.
Howard, Graham, and McCann were able to go from moving hundreds of kilos of hashish per shipment to moving thousands of kilos per shipment. Howard started making 50,000 pounds on each load they smuggled in.
But for every deal that worked out, there was another one that went wrong. Once, all the hashish was stolen out of the stash house. After McCann heroically recovered some of it, Howard couldn't help suspecting that perhaps McCann had stolen it in the first place so he could sell the lost portion and pocket the profits. He knew that for McCann, money would always mean more than trust with his business partners.
By the beginning of 1973, Howard had had it with his Irish partner's reckless behavior. Howard had some money saved up, and he decided to invest it in a deal that didn't involve McCann. Hopefully, he would soon be able to cut ties with the madman altogether.
Graham had a connection who shipped equipment for rock groups touring the United States. At the time, British pop was in its full glory, and bands like Pink Floyd and Genesis were touring the U.S. with semi-trucks full of instruments, amplifiers, and staging gear.
Because the equipment was only in the U.S. temporarily, not permanently, it wasn't examined thoroughly by customs. Assuming the proper paperwork could be forged, the shipments should slide right through.
The most enticing part of the deal was that the hashish sold for triple the price on the American market. If they pulled this off, it meant triple profits all around, and they didn't even have to sell any dope themselves.
The new scheme was put into motion in March 1973. Howard made arrangements for a couple hundred kilos of Durrani's hashish to be driven out to the Parisian countryside.
In a remote stash house, Howard and a group of associates disassembled a collection of amps and other musical equipment, crammed it with hashish, then reassembled it and packaged it to ship.
The plans hit a snag when Howard realized that there weren't any real Parisian bands touring the U.S. at that time. He scrambled to assemble four unemployed musicians into a fake band, embarking on a fake tour to California. Everyone agreed on the band name, Laughing Grass.
The band and their equipment were flown from Paris to Los Angeles. They were received by Ernie Combs, a member of the Brotherhood of Eternal Love.
The Brotherhood of Eternal Love, also known as the Hippie Mafia, was an organization born out of the peace and love movements of the 1960s. Their goal was to initiate a psychedelic revolution by producing and distributing drugs around the United States.
Howard described Ernie as tall, thin, bearded, bespectacled, long-haired, and suntanned. He was Californian. Howard enjoyed dealing with Ernie, and he identified with the nonviolent, laid-back approach that the Brotherhood took to business. It was a nice change after McCann.
In the summer and fall of 1973, when Howard was 27, he and Ernie put together a plan to import 317 kilos of Lebanese hashish into Las Vegas. Once the shipment was squared away, Ernie invited Howard to Los Angeles to pick up his own share of the profit. Howard agreed. He was eager to see California.
Howard liked the Golden State, but it was pretty overwhelming. Ernie invited him to surf, sail, or ride motorcycles in the desert, but Howard preferred to get stoned and read or listen to music. He found American cinema self-obsessed and hard to identify with. The numerous radio and television channels were constantly interrupted by commercials.
The only palatable television program Howard came across was the news. That's what he was watching in his Newport Beach hotel room in September 1973 when the reporter announced, "Hey, one of you guys out there has just lost $5 million. Today, law enforcement officers seized Nevada's biggest ever haul of illegal drugs. Hashish, highly concentrated cannabis from the Middle East, almost half a ton of it, was discovered hidden in speaker cabinets.
Howard's heart stopped. Images of the speakers he had jam-packed with hashish himself were on the screen. But now, those speakers were surrounded by DEA agents.
Howard was too stoned to respond. Instead of turning off the TV, he stared at it for another hour in shock. Was this really happening? Ernie was outside his hotel room. It was happening.
Ernie gave Howard all the details on the bust. It happened purely by chance. When the shipment was transferred onto a different plane in New York, the airport loaders missed one of the speakers accidentally. The plane to Las Vegas took off with one of the speakers left behind on the tarmac.
The forgotten speaker was stored overnight in a shed. In the morning, a drug-sniffing dog found it. The DEA intercepted the rest of the shipment in Las Vegas. The remaining speakers were all disassembled, and the drugs inside were seized. Then, the DEA got crafty. They returned the empty speakers to the pickup area to see who would pick them up.
Ernie's driver picked up the shipment, but noticed the tail before he led the DEA agents back to any of his associates. That driver was now in custody, but Ernie reassured Howard that he'd hung tough in Vietnam, so there was no way he was going to crack now.
Despite his confidence in his driver's loyalty, Ernie and Howard were both in danger of being arrested themselves. Ernie handed Howard $10,000 in cash and advised him to get home. Howard flew from Los Angeles to New York under a false name, then to London under his own name. He was safe for now.
Only a few weeks after Howard returned to the United Kingdom, his connection that shipped the speakers to Las Vegas was also busted. Howard's paranoia increased every day. It felt like law enforcement was closing in.
Because so many people working with him had been arrested, he had to assume that law enforcement knew his name and was actively looking for him. That meant he couldn't travel under his own identity. The only place he could go without a passport was Ireland. Though it was separate from Britain, Ireland is a part of the United Kingdom and would thus accept travelers from Great Britain. And if he wanted to work in Ireland, he'd have to go back to his old IRA contact.
For better or for worse, Howard was back in bed with McCann. But even though Howard was hot, McCann had no intention of allowing him to lay low. If he was going to take refuge in Ireland, he was going to work.
Even though he couldn't leave the UK under his own name, McCann badgered Howard into traveling under a false passport. Against his better judgment, Howard agreed to drive a car stashed with hashish from Hamburg, Germany to Ireland via ferry. But as soon as Howard reached Hamburg, things started to go wrong. He left his Hamburg hotel phone number with a contact in London named Marty Langford. Marty was unexpectedly busted, and Howard's location in Germany was blown.
In a panic, Howard abandoned the car full of hashish, fled his hotel, and went straight to the airport.
He looked up at the flight schedule and saw that the next two flights departing were to Paris and Helsinki. In his panic, he couldn't remember which country Helsinki was in, so he hopped on the flight to Paris to be safe, and eventually made his way to Amsterdam.
Howard spent the next several days in a panic, trying to contact McCann or Graham, but getting no answer. When McCann finally called, his rage had reached new heights. When Howard disappeared, McCann had sent his girlfriend to Hamburg to pick up the stashed car. She was busted, and now she was in jail in Hamburg.
When Howard hung up, he knew it would be a long time before he and McCann could work together again. In fact, Howard would probably do best to avoid him altogether.
The good news was, Howard had many contacts of his own in Amsterdam, and cannabis was decriminalized there for recreational use. It was easy to find distributors looking to increase their sales in other countries. Howard called Ernie, who flew out to help drum up business. He gave Howard $100,000 for startup costs and a few ounces of hashish.
A few weeks after the Las Vegas bust, Howard finally felt like things might be stabilizing. In October of 1973, he was in the apartment of an Amsterdam supplier named Arend. They packed some of Ernie's hashish into a pipe and lit up.
Suddenly, there were six Dutch policemen at the door. Howard did his best to stay cool. He immediately stood, telling the policeman that he had to leave for an appointment. He tried to walk out the door, hoping his usual confidence would serve him.
It didn't. One of the policemen insisted on searching him. The officer reached into Howard's pocket and pulled out a piece of hash. That was enough to arrest him.
But Howard was even more upset when the policeman pulled out his passport. Now there was no hope for Howard to avoid extradition back to Britain, where he would face charges for the Las Vegas bust.
Howard hung his head as he was escorted into a police car. He was really and truly busted. But he still had a few tricks up his sleeve.
Thanks again for listening to Kingpins. Join us next week to find out how Howard dodges law enforcement and achieves folk hero status by outsmarting the British justice system.
You can find more episodes of Kingpins and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Kingpins, for free, from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Kingpins on Spotify, just open the app and type Kingpins in the search bar.
Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time. Kingpins was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, with sound design by Russell Nash. Production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Liebeskind. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. This episode of Kingpins was written by Hannah McIntosh and stars Kate Leonard and Howell Hargett.